Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Welcome to Season 4, Episode 6 of the Center of Everywhere podcast. I'm Marnie Werner, and I'm the Vice President of Research at the Center for Rural Policy and Development. We are a private, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization based in rural Minnesota, where we are dedicated to providing data-driven research on rural issues to help our policymakers make more informed decisions affecting the rural people and places of our state. So we have a guest today. Today we have on Terry Fritzma. She is the lead healthcare workforce analyst at the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care within the Department of Health. And boy, I thought I had the longest title and organization name, but you have one too. So
just go on.
Healthcare workforce is a big issue these days. So Terry, why don't you tell us about what you and your team do at the Department of Health, and why is it so important to collect this data on licensed healthcare providers?
Great. Thank you so much, Marnie, for having me on. I really appreciate it. I always appreciate the opportunity to talk about what we do at the Department of Health. We're sort of a nice, well-kept secret. My group is called the Health Workforce Analysis Unit, and we are a small group, like you said, nestled within MDH and within the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. And so the things that keep us up at night in particular have to do with healthcare access, particularly for rural communities around the state. And so our small part of that, my small group, looks specifically at the healthcare workforce, as you said. And we actually have a legislative mandate to conduct a survey of the entire licensed healthcare workforce. So that's going to include folks like the people that we're really familiar with, like physicians, nurses, physician assistants, but also others that we might not think about quite as often. So that would include the mental health, the entire mental health workforce, the licensed part of the mental health workforce, the entire oral health workforce. So dentists, dental therapists, dental hygienists, dental assistants, many of the allied health professions like respiratory therapists and occupational therapists and pharmacists and physical therapists. So it's a lot of folks that we survey. We are up to about 200,000 in our survey.
Wow.
And the way we do it is we actually insert the survey in the license renewal process. So we're kind of sneaky about it because people can't really get past the survey until they can't really make it to payment until they take the survey, which means that we have really, really high data quality. That's kind of written in statute that we're to implement the survey that way. But it really, really provides high quality data. It gives us the sample sizes that we need in order to really study the rural healthcare workforce, which makes Minnesota, you know, really fortunate that we actually have some solid data on our rural healthcare providers. With the survey, we've been doing the survey for more than 10 years for most of the workforce. And so we have a set of questions that we ask every year that kind of allow us to sort of track generally what's going on in the workforce and you know, when things are changing, say like if there's a big pandemic and we need to find out what's going on in the healthcare workforce, we're able to kind of track those things over time. And then we also ask specialty questions or sort of questions that people are talking about and want to get answers to. So right now, there's a lot of talk, as I'm sure you and I'm sure your listeners know, about burnout in the healthcare workforce and, you know, premature exits and things like that. So now we have kind of a special module in our survey looking at that. So in about a year's time, we'll have a lot more data on that. So, and many other topics, telehealth, things, and we can talk about some of the stuff as we go, but so it's a really, really rich set of data, that allow us to understand what's going on around the state. And I think Minnesota is very lucky because our legislature, 20 years ago recognized this need and told MDH to do it. So here we are.
Yeah, and just being able to understand who is out there and where and with which specialties, as we found in our research, is really important. And so, yeah, we're really glad that you guys are working on that. So as you conduct your research and survey these providers each year, what are some of the, are there any standout findings that you're learning about in the workforce, particularly in rural Minnesota?
Yes, there really are. And, as you might imagine, and you probably already know, and I think your listeners will already know, it's not a super pretty picture right now in healthcare and in healthcare in general, or I should say the healthcare workforce, and then rural areas too. I find so many of our findings really fascinating, but right now I'm kind of grappling with sort of four kind of big findings.
Okay.
And some of these, and honestly, all of these are they're specific to rural, but they're also statewide. So I'm going to kind of sort of go back and forth between what we're seeing statewide and kind of how that applies to the rural areas in our state as well. So the big, kind of the way that I would describe the situation right now is, first, the healthcare workforce, and this is across really all of our professions, from direct care providers all the way up to really kind of niche medical specialties, all of them are in severe shortage, a state of severe shortage. And I'm going to say more about each one of these if you'll permit me,
mm-hmm.
After I kind of march through the kind of the big picture. So the second thing that we're seeing from our data is that the healthcare workforce is burned out. That is not a big surprise to people who are listening, I'm sure. it's sort of the big thing that people are talking about these days. People are burned out and they're exiting the workforce prematurely in a variety of different ways. And again, I'll say a little bit more about that. With respect to rural specifically, another thing that we're seeing is that the healthcare workforce is very geographically maldistributed.
Okay, yeah.
That's a big word for me. I'm going to say that again. Geographically maldistributed. So what that means is, in general, shortages, and this is no surprise again, shortages are worse in rural areas than in urban ones. And some of the numbers that I can share are really pretty eye-opening. And then the final point is that we have the ability to look at both kind of the demand, the projected demand for people, and the supply that we're producing within Minnesota. And what we can see from just comparing, kind of a crude comparison of those two sets of numbers, is that across the board, the pipeline of new workers is just not keeping up with the demand. We're really falling short. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is true of pretty much every profession for which we have data. So it's not the prettiest mm-hmm. picture. I always start off with sort of the bad news. And if you like, I can go into a little bit more detail on each one of these to sort of put some numbers on the general picture.
Well, yeah. And I'll just ask first. So is this so many people leaving the workforce and then not enough people coming in behind? Yeah, burnout is one factor. Mm-hmm. Is it also those baby boomers leaving and just that there's a smaller population behind, or is it that people just aren't choosing healthcare as a profession?
Yeah, and I think it's both of those. I think we're
okay.
seeing, so that's a great question. And I think it's, sort of thinking about what was going on in the labor market, even before COVID hit, we know that Minnesota and the United States in general is aging. And so for that reason, we've been, those of us who pay attention to these things, and I think that's a lot of us, have been expecting this so-called silver tsunami for a long time. So retirements and that kind of thing. What happened with COVID that no one could have predicted, because no one predicted COVID, Plenty of people predicted COVID, but not us. We did not predict COVID. I meaning not research analysts that are studying this workforce did not predict COVID. And so what we saw at the very beginning of COVID was a lot of people dropping out and retiring at the very beginning who might otherwise have stayed in for another few years just because they saw what was happening. They said, you know what? I was going to retire next year. Now's the time. I'm just going to go ahead and retire now. And so that happened at the beginning. And so now, so of course, at the beginning of COVID, we were already sort of left with a smaller workforce. And then what happened during the course of COVID really stretched the resources that we had even further. And so now we're continuing to see, just as you suspect, retirement, but we're also seeing people who are, again, like I said, burned out and planning on leaving sooner than they otherwise might have.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you wanted to go into a little more detail in some of those factors then?
Yeah. So as a numbers person, as a research analyst, I always like to put some numbers onto these things because I think they really tell the story better than I could, just sort of describing things. So just thinking about shortages in general, it's always tempting. And I think people are always looking for, okay, tell me the number that we're short. Like, we know we don't have enough doctors. How many doctors are we short? Come up with a number, or, nurses or whatever it might be. And so I always push back gently on that and say, it's really difficult to quantify shortages because, and you'll know this, there's, first of all, there's always an urban story and a rural story. Those two things can be very, very different. And so another way to say that is, shortages are very local. So what's going on, in the state is not necessarily going on in Roseau or Mankato or Rochester or whatever it might be. So there's that issue. And the numbers don't always get down to that level of detail. But the other thing that I think is really interesting in healthcare is that the mix of who is doing the care is very, it can be fluid because a physician assistant can in some cases do the work that a physician would do, or an advanced practice registered nurse can in some cases do that work. Not all of it, but some of it. And so if you have one APRN in an area, that can really, that can really make a huge difference in a small community. So these factors just kind of get in the way of coming up with just a nice tidy number. Mm-hmm. But that being said, like to look at shortages, I look at the vacancy rates, first of all, over time. And so what I can see by looking at kind of a long time series, both before and during and then after COVID, we can see that job vacancy rates in the healthcare sector, so the entire sector of healthcare, not any specific occupation. So before COVID, the number of job openings at any one time was hovering between 3,000 and 5,000. Now, right after COVID, in the second quarter of 2020, that number shot up to more than double. So we're up to about 8,000. And then by 2022, it was over 10,000. And it hasn't come down yet. Wow. So that's really quite staggering. I mean, it really tells a picture, especially since job vacancies are a leading indicator of shortages. But so that's, and that's statewide. And of course, as I said before, and as I know that whatever's going on statewide, you can almost guarantee that it's exacerbated in rural areas. But another thing that I think that's going on that our data help us to understand that I think is sort of interesting is that even though we can look at the supply of these workers, and by supply, when I talk about supply, I'm actually thinking about just the sheer number of licensed providers that are licensed and registered with their licensing board. So the number of, say, like RNs or nurses that have an active license. So what we can see is that over time, and even during COVID, that share those numbers were actually increasing. They have not gone down, with only one exception, and that's licensed practical nurse, because that's a very long-standing pattern that we're just losing LPNs. But in general, we are seeing that for all healthcare specialties, so for all of these licensees, the number of licensees has been growing over time, and even during COVID. However, what's changed is the share of those licensees that are actually providing patient care. There's always some share of providers that are not doing patient care. They're doing all sorts of things. They're maybe working in insurance, or they're maybe taking time out of the labor force or whatever. There's always some level of churn. So we just expect that. But in 2019, let's just take a look at registered nurses statewide. So in 2019, about 83% of registered nurses were working in patient care roles. But by 2023, that was down to 76%. And that is a loss of about 8,500 nurses around the state. So, which we did not have to lose in the first place. We did, I'm now kind of zeroing in on, what's going on, post-COVID or as a result of COVID, but COVID did not cause all of these shortage issues. They were happening before. So same thing is true for mental health clinicians. I mean, in fact, same thing is true just across the board. But like, for example, within mental health in 2019, 85% of these folks were working in patient care roles. But by 2023, that share was down to 76%. So you really kind of have to dig into these numbers to see what's going on with supply. It may be that these folks are, they're achieving, they're earning their licenses, they're keeping their licenses, but they, for a variety of reasons, much of which I my hunch is that that it has to do with burnout, based on what the data is telling me, is that they're just choosing to step away from patient care roles. And again, this is, pretty much for all of the professions that we collect data on, we're seeing these patterns. These are just the numbers. These are just what the data tells me. Like you, and I'm sure like everyone, we also hear a lot of stories, a lot of anecdotes of employers not being able to find employees, having job openings, vacant for over a year, that sort of thing. So, in this case, the data and the anecdotes are really lining up, which is not always the case. I can talk a little bit about kind of some of these premature exits and burnout. So again, I'm kind of comparing the pre-COVID levels to what we're seeing now. And again, we're just seeing, so we ask on our survey, people's level of job satisfaction, within the last year and in their career overall. And so across the board, we're seeing levels of job satisfaction decrease. So again, I'll just take an example, but for registered nurses, the share of people who reported that they were very satisfied with their work in the last year dropped from 38% in 2019 to 24% in 2023. Very similar. I'm just taking our RNs as an example, because I think people are really, RNs are the workforce that tend to, they do really, really do so much work in patient care, and they absolutely took so much of the brunt of the work in COVID. But they're not the only groups. They're not the only profession types that are experiencing this type of drop in work satisfaction. It's kind of across the board: physician assistants, respiratory therapists, physicians, for example. And so that's leading to more people saying that they plan to leave the workforce. And again, it's across the board. It's across every profession. So for example, we've had this long trend of losing licensed practical nurses for a whole variety of reasons. Many of them are actually moving into registered nursing roles, RN roles. But just looking at the data, so before COVID, So we ask a question every single year. We ask a question on the survey, how much longer do you plan to work in this profession? And so, and then we allow people to tell us less than 5 years, five to 10 years, or more than 10 years. So let's zero in on LPNs for a second. So before COVID, 18% of LPNs said they plan to leave within the next 5 years. After COVID, it was 22%. So we just, and again, mm-hmm. this is across the board. I'm saying the same thing over and over, because it's just so striking. So, and then to kind of punctuate all of this, we are seeing that of those planned exits, before COVID, about 5% of those exits were due to burnout. After COVID, it's up to 12%. So that's a loss of about 5,000 healthcare providers in the
state. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then one more soapbox issue that I'll go into, and that's what I mentioned about maldistribution.
Right.
And this really gets into some of the pain that I think rural communities are facing, or are struggling with respect to accessing care. So when we think of rural areas in my little kind of my framework, the framework that I use, I think of, we use a concept called RUCA, which may be familiar to you and some of your listeners, but it's a way of understanding, kind of categorizing how rural a place is. So when I think of the communities that we classify as either small town or isolated rural, so, that's going to be places sort of smaller than the Twin Cities, smaller than Rochester, Duluth, even St. Cloud in the state of Minnesota. We know that about 15% of Minnesotans live in those areas, but only about 9.8% of our healthcare workforce is practicing in those communities. And that's just overall. But in general, the more specialized the care, the worse the maldistribution. So, for example, like I said, 15% of Minnesotans live in these small towns or rural communities. Less than 5% of physicians are practicing in those communities. And so, and if you zero in even further and you look at isolated rural areas, and so these are areas that don't have, an urban core. They don't have, sort of think of it an area that doesn't really have a downtown, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That represents about 8% of Minnesota's population and just 1% of our physicians.
Okay.
So, and to go even dive in even a little bit further in Minnesota. So again, if you took all those small towns and rural communities in Minnesota, you would find only about 20 psychiatrists practicing in those towns. You mm-hmm. would find less than 20 pediatricians, and you would find about 30 OBGYNs. And sort of, again, the more specialized, the fewer of these folks you're going to find. So
yeah.
It's rather dire.
Yeah.
And I'll just add, sorry to go on and on, but I'll just add that in those areas, we're seeing, not just these small numbers, but we also from our survey know that anywhere between 20 and 50% of these folks report on their survey that they plan to leave their profession within the next 5 years. So it becomes really important to figure out how can we get more folks working in those positions and, in those small town rural areas.
Yeah, and that leads perfectly into the next question, which is you've been working with the University of Minnesota on a study about what motivates healthcare students to eventually practice in rural areas. So that's part of the what do we do about it part of this whole issue. So what did you learn from that?
Yeah, I'm so happy that you asked me about that. That's the findings from that study. So What we did with that study is we know already just from other literature, you know, from anecdotes, that if you grow up in a rural area, you're far more likely to decide to live in, as a healthcare provider, you're far more likely to decide, I want to practice in a rural area. You're familiar with those areas. You know, maybe you want to go back and serve your community. There's a whole lot of reasons why somebody who grew up in a rural area would want to stay in a rural area. So we knew that, but that's not anything that we as policymakers or analysts or stakeholders can do anything about, you know. But what we can do things about are, number one, how would we recruit people? What's the best recruiting messages that we might want to think about? Number two, what are the best ways to educate people so they might be interested in working in these areas or practicing in these areas? And number three, what are the various levers that the state might have at their disposal to, you know, incentivize rural practice? And so we, in our survey, we asked people to sort of tell us, not only, you know, where did you grow up? We happen to know where people are practicing because that's data that we receive from the licensing board. So we have that, we have a measure of where people are practicing. And then we asked people a bunch of questions about what are the things that you really considered when you were deciding where you wanted to live and practice. And then we threw it all into a big statistical meat grinder and found some really interesting things. And I think a little bit of, you know, some counterintuitive things as well. So for example, I think there's a general idea out there that, you know, the thing that pulls people to rural areas is that just the quality of life in rural areas, you know, it can be the slower pace, the natural beauty, things like that. And no question that those are good attractors, but as it turns out, once you control on where someone grew up, in other words, once you account for that, those lifestyle factors kind of disappear as predictors of where people want to live. Instead, the things that actually come out are, number one, how someone was educated in their formal training. Did their formal training prepare them to practice in a rural area? So that was a significant predictor for, and we looked at, and by the way, the study looked at physicians, physician assistants, advanced practice registered nurses, and registered nurses. And so that finding held true for all four of those groups. Another thing that made a big difference was loan forgiveness. So if someone thought that they would be eligible for loan forgiveness, or if they had received loan forgiveness, they were much more likely to choose to practice in rural, regardless of where they grew up. So loan forgiveness and educate and you know, having trained in a program that prepared you to do rural actually can redistribute people from urban areas into rural areas, and absolutely retains people from rural areas to practice in rural areas.
Okay.
And then, so those were good findings. And I think those are things that, you know, speak to various interventions. You know, I'm thinking of kind of the State Cloud, the St. Cloud campus that's opening up. I think that shows, you know, the data suggests that that'll be a very promising, thing to do in terms of growing the rural workforce. The other thing that showed up in our models that I had not expected was something that really attracts providers to these rural areas is the nature of practice itself. So, so you know, in urban areas, just because they're more densely populated, there are more providers working around you, as a provider, you tend to specialize. But in rural areas, you are able to practice, you know, in a more, you know, kind of, you're able to have more of a broad scope of practice. You're able to have more autonomy in your work, and sort of do, you know, kind of whole person care. And those things tended to pop out at for three out of our four provider groups. Those popped out as really significant predictors of whether or not people would choose to practice in rural areas. So that's super heartening, I think, to learn, because it tells us there are things that we can do about this, and there are ways that we can pitch rural practice as as being really a great way to practice for some of these providers. And I think when I'm not a provider and I'm not, mm-hmm. I don't work in healthcare, but I think when I look at these findings, I think, yeah, I get it, because you're able to care for the whole person. You're able to develop these relationships, over the lifespan. You get to know your patients or your clients, in a more holistic way. And so I think this is some interesting research that I think if I were doing recruiting, that's the way I would recruit people, is to kind of talk about the nature of practice.
Definitely. Is that report out yet?
It is. Yes. Okay. It's out in it's a JAMA article, actually.
Okay.
Yep.
Oh,
so
great.
I can send you a link. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That is encouraging, because now we can have some solid underpinnings for the solutions that we might be looking at.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah. Okay. So moving to mental health now, that's a big topic. That's a great concern all over the state, but especially in Greater Minnesota. So in all the years you've been collecting the data on mental health providers, how has that shifted? How have you seen that particular workforce develop?
Yeah, this is really interesting. We do see shifts. They're happening slowly over time, and there's a few interesting things going on. So one of the things that we're seeing is that the profession of psychology is it's an aging profession. So the median age of psychologists is somewhere, it hovers around 57 or 58, which, so to give you, like, by comparison, the median age in the workforce as a whole in Minnesota is about 40. So they're really, demographically, it's an older group, and it's a shrinking profession. I guess it's fair to say. They're doing amazing work, psychologists, but they're sort of beginning, a lot of the work in mental health is beginning to be done more by licensed practical clinical counselors, licensed marriage and family therapists, and particularly social workers. Social work is the largest group of mental health providers in the state. And not only that, but they're doing a lot. All of our professions are quote unquote mal distributed around the state, but social workers tend to be slightly less mal distributed in that they, you'll find social workers working out in Greater Minnesota, and it's a little harder to find, say, as I mentioned, a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So that's one big shift that we're seeing. Another, shortages are real and dire in mental health, just like all of the others. I mean, I haven't said as much about mental health, but they're just as bad in mental health as they are in all of the other professions. So we tend to hear more about nurses. We tend to hear more about physicians and less about mental health, but mental health occupations have some of the highest vacancy rates in the state, even higher than registered nurses, the last I checked. So that's, for the first time since I've been doing this work in the last couple of years. So anecdotes about shortages always come before we see the patterns in the broad data. We always start hearing about shortages and difficulties in hiring before we can see those patterns show up in our data. But now the anecdotes and the data are, for better or worse, they are quite aligned. So we see evidence of shortages in the data statewide and in rural areas. But there's a bit of a bright light in mental health, and that is the adoption of telemedicine that happened as the result, as the direct result of COVID. So we see in our data that, when you think about telemedicine, you have to think about, well, so there's, how many providers are actually using telemedicine to provide care to their patients, and what share of their encounters are done with telemedicine. And so we're seeing increases in both of those indicators. So just to give you an example, like alcohol and drug counselors, in 2019, about 27% of alcohol and drug counselors were using telehealth, at least in some of their clinical encounters. Today, that number is up to 64, or that share is up to 64%. That's more than double of alcohol and drug counselors that are reaching clients via telemedicine. Mental health providers are sort of as a group. So combining, you know, there's four different license types among mental health professionals. So back in 2019, 21% of them were using telehealth to reach their clients or patients. Today, it's up to 80%. So, I mean, really, those professions have just seen a shift in kind of the nature of you know, the way that they provide care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we also, some of the questions that we ask on our survey are, you know, because when we think of telemedicine, we always think, well, oh, this must be good news for rural areas. This must be that, you know, we're getting, you know, we're actually being able to reach rural people who, you know, it might be a 30-mile drive or more to go and see a mental health provider. And so we asked a question on our survey to try to get at that. And the question we asked was, it's a little bit of a mouthful, but not including those who are on vacation or at a cabin, how often do you provide care via telemedicine to people who live in areas that are more rural than where you practice? So essentially, when you're doing telemedicine, are you actually reaching people that are rural? You know, we were trying to get at this idea, like, is this just all in our minds, or are people actually, you know, reaching those rural communities? And so what we found was really, really heartening in that 38% of providers who use telemedicine say they're reaching people that are more rural than where they practice at least daily or weekly. And so that's really heartening. And we also heard just through some of our open-ended questions on the survey that especially in mental health, telemedicine really has a strong potential to open up access. You know, I mentioned kind of the issue of driving, you know, driving Minnesota winter can, you know, to an appointment can be really difficult, but also in telehealth, there's quite a stigma of showing up, you know, to a psychologist's office. And, you know, perhaps that stigma is higher in rural areas. And so that when you're calling in, that stigma is taken away. And so providers tell us that, you know, they have fewer no-shows, they have fewer cancellations. And so it does seem to really be making a difference. So that's, you know, even though we're seeing these shortages, that's quite a bright light, I think.
Yeah, really. Well, yeah. that is great news. And so, mental health. And then the other big issue with healthcare in rural areas is that our population does skew older. We have in general an older population. And so we're already facing a big demand for healthcare workers that specialize in geriatric health. What have you noticed about that sector of the workforce? Have you been looking at that at all, especially in rural areas?
Yeah, I mean, so in truth, we don't have good data. I could do a little bit more digging on this and send you this information, but I didn't really have time to look at those specialties in our data.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the last day or two, but and Deed doesn't collect data on that sector, that, you know, the geriatric specialties. But I mean, what I can say is just thinking maybe kind of at, you know, more of a sort of an age in place lens, looking at these long-term care facilities, I think everybody who's paying attention to these issues understands that this is just such a pain point in the healthcare workforce. And so it's not, you know, this isn't referring to, you know, kind of doctors that are specializing in geriatric care, but more kind of that direct care workforce that are working in you know, assisted living facilities or skilled nursing facilities. I mean, they're facing just drastic shortages, and not just of the, you know, kind of that direct care workforce, but also of the director level, you know, the licensed folks that are administering those facilities. And so we're, so stay tuned on that, because we're actually right in the middle of a really good in-depth study on what, entices, those workers to stay in that work, and what interventions, you know, this is kind of similar to the other study, that I talked about, but what interventions can we, you know, can we think about, you know, can we think out of the box about, things that we can do to really make that work more attractive and make, you know, help people stay in that work longer. So
it seems like we have only scratched the surface with all of this. I know there's so much more we could talk about. But is there anything else you wanted to add that we didn't cover here?
Well, there's two things. I always, whenever I get a chance to have a mouthpiece, I always like to say thank you to any provider who's taken our survey and to our licensing boards, because they're really excellent partners in helping us administer our survey. And without the survey, we just wouldn't, we wouldn't have this information. So I like to always throw that out. And I guess the other thing, you know, as sort of a silver lining, I mean, there was a lot of bad news in what I said, but as sort of a silver lining, I would say, you know, if I'd rather be in Minnesota than just about anywhere else, because what I'm seeing from my vantage point is just a lot of partnerships and a lot of different groups that are looking at these issues, understanding the issues, and really rowing in the same direction. And I think there's a spirit of, you know, we're all going to work together to get this, you know, to help fix these issues as best we can. And so, you know, I always want to be a cheerleader for Minnesota, because I see, I mean, I see that spirit of collaboration and cooperation in Minnesota, I think, more than elsewhere. So,
That is,
my money is on our state.
That's so encouraging. So encouraging to hear.
Yeah.
Well, great. It has been so great having you on, and I hope we can do this again sometime. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Marnie. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.